then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, a woke, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's August the 14th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Once again this week, we'll start with some housekeeping notes. Okay, you folks may recall the Chicago guy I've mentioned in the past. Well, Chicago guy, listen up good. This is the last time I'm going to use this program to communicate with you. In a way, by doing so, I am validating your internet stalker, and when he hears this, that I have been reduced to wasting valuable airtime on my show to send smoke signals because you can't be bothered to maintain secure communications, he's probably going to have an orgasm. By talking to you like this, I am making the stalker's wet dream come true. I am making it all about him. I am acknowledging his existence, and that's what he lives for, so you'd better get your act together because I'm not doing this anymore. Now, you need to put the paranoia on hold and get a proper mailing address with a proper name, your own, where the mail is not returned by the post office. Now, if you don't want him playing games with you, then don't publicize the post office box. If we're going to do anything together, that means communication. Postal is okay if you really want to wait several weeks at a time for acknowledgement, which is about the kind of priority paper mail has with me right now, since 97% of what I do is electronic. Otherwise, you're going to need a functioning email address that does not come bouncing back, and which you have authenticated in the manner you know so that I know it's you and not the stalker. Takes less than 5 minutes to set up a simple web-based email address. Now, true, your stalker does seem to have ways of finding out your email addresses and movement pseudonyms fairly quickly, and using those names and email addresses to post homosexual soliloquies and the cyber equivalent of shouted obscenities all over the internet, including some attempts to post comments to the NF's Thought Crime and Northwest Homeland blogs this week. Yes, he's doing it again this week. I'll give you two guesses. Either you are the victim of a really thorough hacker, or else it's someone close to you. Now, I read an article on the internet about 6 months ago about obsessive stalkers, and it stated that a large percentage of cyber stalkers, how big a percentage I can't recall, were in fact known to the victim and maintained their lines of personal information and data mining by simply pretending to be a friend. Now, sometimes people are cyber stalked for years, and they only find out by accident that it's one of their so-called BFFs. Now, it's interesting that this week we're going to be talking about various disadvantages and advantages of both the Rotary Club approach to white nationalism and the secret squirrel approach, because Chicago Guy's story seems to indicate that neither works when you're dealing with a nut. Now, I myself can tell you from long personal experience, in this society, there is simply no way to defend yourself from a nut. Someone who either isn't afraid of the usual deterrents, or who has good reason to believe that he has an official exemption from the law, as some of these people have, if they're harassing and annoying white nationalists for a living, and yes, those kinds of trolls most certainly do exist. Anyway, Chicago guy, if you're going to be involved with us, even to the tentative level you are, we need to be able to communicate. set up a secure email and postal address, or just wander on off. This is getting close to games playing. And I don't do games or jump through hoops, even for financial support and good printed postcards. Second item of business. I need some more business cards and little guys, brochures and whatnot. Now, the way that this has been working for some years is that we have all kinds of people who are willing to sit behind their computers and design all kinds of really superb-looking business cards and stickers and fold-over brochures. No kidding, we produce some really great-looking stuff over the years, which almost nobody has ever actually seen on the street. These creative types then send these images to me by email, attachment, or FTP, and for most of them, that's the end of it. They rely on the party's infinite financial resources and on my huge staff here in my secret bunker headquarters to make sure that their work actually gets produced, which of course means that most of these designs remain on people's hard drives and never actually see the light of day. Now, to be sure, a few of you do go so far as to print out some of these business cards, brochures, and whatnot on your own home printers in what I'm sure you think is bulk quantity. Now, this usually means 30 or 40 copies, maybe as many as 100 fold-over brochures, whatever. It's not enough for a complete Northwest Observer mailing, so what I do with these is I send them out in intro packs, so people will be able to see what we're capable of if we ever decide we really want to do this Northwest thing, and we make the decision to get our act together. What's really embarrassing is when I get these enthusiastic responses saying, "Hey, Harold, that printed thing you sent me is really great! Where can I order 500 copies?" And I have to send someone an email or a letter revealing to them that I don't have 500 copies to send them, probably will never have 500 copies to send them, and that this was a once-off thing that somebody did on their own printer as a hobby before they lost interest because the party isn't producing immediate spectacular results and they wandered away. Now, do you begin to see how our lack of results is self-perpetuating? How we're always waiting for someone else to do it? On the last Northwest Observer, most of you will have received an example of those cards that the Chicago guy made for us. Aren't they great? Why do we not have tens of thousands of these being distributed on the street? Well, in the first place, I can't get more than a handful of you to open the checkbooks, and in the second place, the man who designed them can't be bothered to maintain a functioning email address or post office box. I can't communicate with him, never mind place bulk orders. He's spending his time in an effort trying to hide from a single internet stalker who's posing as him on the net instead of serving the 14 words. Anyway, guys, look, those of you who have in the past done brochures and business cards and leaflets and whatnot, and who have not lost interest and wandered away looking for a bigger movement sugar rush, I need you to run off some more, please. More business cards, more postcards, more brochures, more stickers. Our intro packs are getting a little drab with nothing but black and white Northwest Observers and the white book, and I need these little splotches of color to throw in. And yes, I know the process that I just described sounds depressing and defeatist and pathetic. I agree. It is. Well, if you don't like it, change it. Get your ass moving and start producing your own material, and beyond that, get your butt up from behind that computer and get out there and actually physically distribute party literature where real, white, non-movement people can find it and read it and jump up and down about it. Take reasonable security precautions, but beyond that, don't worry about getting caught. The 14 words is more important than your personal well-being. Get your ass up here to the homeland where you belong and help me from right here by my side and not 1,000 miles away while hiding behind a computer. Capiche? Also, guys, when you are sending me audios for Radio Free Northwest, please make sure that you send me MP3 files only, ready to play. Not weird little formats that I have to download all kinds of off-brand Indonesian shareware off strange internet sites to listen to. I can convert a few formats to MP3 myself, like whatever the trucker uses on his phone, and I do have a guy who can strip MP3 soundtracks off YouTubes. But it's much quicker and easier for me, and much more polite if you do that yourself and just send me an MP3. Okay, tell you what, now for something completely different. I have often in the past had people urge me to get more into my personal views on religion and the occult and mystical things, which I've always avoided doing and which I'm not going to do now. I have also restrained other mystical and conspiracy theory types, notably Lord Lucan, from getting into these topics because I don't feel most of this stuff is relevant to securing the existence of our people and a future for white children. And also because some of this touches on things that so-called normal white people have been mentally conditioned to reject out of hand, automatically. I have specifically banned any discussion of UFOs and aliens, even though I myself got briefly into the subject in my last Northwest novel, Freedom's Sons. However, for those of you who do keep up with such things, it will not have escaped your notice that down through the past generation or so, there has developed a growing body of quasi-religious conspiracy theory, basically revolving around the idea of lizard people who are secretly hiding among us and controlling us all in various ways. Now, so far as I'm aware, this started with a guy named David Icke or Icky about 15 years ago. Yes, I know how this sounds, and no, I do not personally believe in it. But the simple fact is, the alien lizard people thing has sort of gone viral in the underworld of ideas. It is striking a chord and resonating with all kinds of alternative outlooks, left and right. There is now a fairly widespread idea in some otherwise level-headed people that there are aliens on Earth hiding in various places and ways, and the government is secretly in contact with them and doing deals with them to our disadvantage, which is by no means unbelievable. Once you accept the basic premise that there are malevolent extraterrestrials hiding on Earth, there's no reason at all to believe that the United States government would not be involved with them in some way and conspiring with them to do us harm. Bad stuff is what the United States government does. The exact nature of this contact, or this secret treaty, or whatever, is of course the subject of much speculation in the conspiracy world. Everybody seems to have their own idea as to what the lizard people really want with us. There is also a quasi-religious adjunct to this, that Jews are either reptilian and extraterrestrial themselves, or else they are a separate reptilian order of creation from the rest of us. Now, I have to say that I am in some personal agreement with this myself, not that you can pull off a Jew's head and find Kang and Kodos underneath. This is not an episode of The Simpsons. I'm not saying anything like that. But I think there is something to be said, spiritually at least, for the idea that the Jews are a different and antagonistic species from the rest of humanity, as is demonstrated pretty clearly by their history, and that they were placed here by a different higher power than the one that put the rest of us here. Anyway, the fact is that the lizard people idea is taking hold, and it's getting to the point where I think it deserves at least a nod of recognition as something we're going to be dealing with for quite some time, even if only out on the periphery. It's not a fly-by-night thing, or should I say slither-by-night thing. Anyway, here's Lord Lucan.
Now, Gordon Duff, who runs the website Veterans Today, says that he was a member of Majestic 12, one of the 12 people chosen by the United States military to keep a peace agreement with the aliens. This so-called peace treaty allows the aliens to conquer our planet, and the secret covenant clearly shows that. He was being interviewed on the Mike Harris Show, who is another journalist from Veterans Today. An illusion it will be, so large, so vast, it will escape their perception. Those who will see it will be thought of as insane. We will create separate fronts to prevent them from seeing the connection between us. We will behave as if we are not connected to keep the illusion alive. Our goal will be accomplished one drop at a time, so as to never bring suspicion upon ourselves. This will also prevent them from seeing the changes as they occur. We will always stand above the relative field of their experience, for we know the secrets of the absolute. We will work together always and remain bound by blood and secrecy. Death will come to he who speaks. We will keep their lifespan short and their minds weak while pretending to do the opposite. We will use our knowledge of science and technology in subtle ways so that they will never see what is happening. We will use soft metals, aging accelerators and sedatives in food and water, also in the air. They will be blanketed by poisons everywhere they turn. The soft metals will cause them to lose their minds. We will promise to find a cure for our many fronts. Yet, we will feed them more poison. The poisons will be absorbed through their skin and mouths. They will destroy their minds and reproductive systems. From all this, their children will be born dead, and we will conceal this information. The poisons will be hidden in everything that surrounds them, in what they drink, eat, breathe, and wear. We must be ingenious in dispensing the poisons, for they can see far. We will teach them that the poisons are good, with fun images and musical tones. Those they look up to will help. We will enlist them to push our poisons. They will see our products being used in film and will grow accustomed to them and will never know their true effect when they give birth. We will inject poisons into the blood of their children and convince them it is for their help. We will start early on, when their minds are young. We will target their children and what children love most, sweet things. When their teeth decay, we will fill them with metals that will kill their mind and steal their future. When their ability to learn has been affected, we will create medicine that will make them sicker and cause other diseases for which we will create more medicine. We will render them docile and weak before us by our power. They will grow depressed, slow and obese, and when they come to us for help, we will give them more poison. We will focus their attention toward money and material things, so they may never connect with their inner self. Their minds belong to us, and they will do as we say. If they refuse, we shall find ways to implement mind-altering technology into their lives. We will use fear as our weapon. We will establish their governments and establish opposites within. We will own both sides. We will always hide our objective but carry out our plan. They will perform the labor for us, and we shall prosper from their toil. We will take over their land resources and wealth to exercise total control over them. We will deceive them into accepting laws that will steal the little freedom they will have. We will establish a money system that will imprison them forever, keeping them and their children in debt when they shall band together. We shall accuse them of crimes and present a different story to the world, for we shall own all the media. We will use our media to control the flow of information and their sentiment in our favor. When they shall rise up against us, we shall crush them like insects, for they are less than that. They will be helpless to do anything, for they have no weapons. We will recruit some of their own to carry out our plans. We will promise them eternal life, but eternal life they will never have, for they are not of us. The recruits will be called initiates and will be indoctrinated to believe false rites of passage to higher realms. Members of these groups will think that they are one with us, never knowing the truth. They must never learn this truth, for they will turn against us. For their work they will be rewarded with earthly things and great titles, but never will they be immortal and join us. Never will they receive the light and travel the stars. They will never reach the higher realms. For the killing of their own kind will prevent passage to the realm of enlightenment. This they will never know. Our families will never mix with theirs. Our blood must be pure always, for it is the way. We will make them kill each other when it suits us. We will keep them separated from the oneness by dogma and religion. We will control all aspects of their lives and tell them what to think and how. We will guide them kindly and gently, letting them think they are guiding themselves. We will form an animosity between them through our fractions. When a light shall shine among them, we shall extinguish it by ridicule or death, whichever suits us best. We will accomplish this by using hate as our ally, anger as our friend. The hate will blind them totally. Never shall they see that from their conflicts. We emerge as their rulers. They will be busy killing each other. They will bathe in their own blood and kill their neighbors for as long as we see fit. We will benefit greatly from all this. They will not see us, for they cannot see us. We will continue to prosper from their wars and their deaths. We shall repeat this over and over until our ultimate goal is accomplished. We will continue to make them live in fear and anger through images and sounds. We will use all the tools we have to accomplish this. The tools will be provided by their labor. We will make them hate themselves and their neighbors. Drop by drop, we will advance to our goal. The truth will be hidden in their face, so close they will not be able to focus on until it is too late. Oh yes, so grand the illusion of freedom will be that they will never know they are our slaves. When all is in place, the reality we will have created for them will own them. This reality will be their prison. They will live in self-delusion. When our goal is accomplished, a new era of domination will begin. Their minds will be bound by their beliefs. The beliefs we have established from the time immemorial, but if they ever find out that we are equal, we shall surely perish then. This they must never know. If ever they find out that together they can vanquish us, they will take action. They must never, ever find out what we have done. For if they do, we shall have no place to run, for it will be easy to see who we are once the veil has fallen. Our actions will have revealed who we are, and they will hunt us down, and no person shall give us shelter. This secret covenant by which we shall live the rest of our present and future lives, for this reality will transcend many generations and lifespans. This covenant is sealed by blood, our blood. We, the ones from heaven to earth, came. This covenant must never, ever be known to exist. It must never, ever be written or spoken of, for if it is, the consciousness it will spawn will release the fury of the prime creator upon us, and we shall be cast to the depths from whence we came and remain there until the end of infinity itself. Now, according to the secret covenant, the aliens have supporters on this planet. These supporters appear to be Satanists, such as Rothschild, the Black Monarchs, such as Queen Elizabeth, Prince Philip, and the Dutch Monarchy. The Dutch Monarchy started what is now known as the Bilderberger Group. And according to Gordon Duff, our government has built large underground bases, but for whose benefit? Our tax money has been spent in the trillions of dollars worth on what is known as the Black Budget. All the traitors to our planet who are in on this treason are making millions of dollars taxpayers' expense. Now, is the invasion of South Americans and others an attempt to condition us to an alien invasion? Now, they cannot take over our planet unless we cooperate. The aliens claim to have 100% control over the media. Well, do they? Do they have 100% control over the politicians to support Israel? Now, according to the aliens, they invented our religions. So now, let us take a look at the oldest Abrahamic religion. It is represented by a star, the Star of David. Now, if you are an alien, the star symbol clearly shows that those who worship such a religion are your planetary supporters. Jews consider themselves to be God's chosen race. That is, God's chosen race, not God's chosen religion. Jews consider all other races to be cattle, or in Hebrew, goyim. Now, the seven golden lampstand found in every synagogue represents seven nations more populous than you are that were exterminated by the Jews. Now, that is not the only Abrahamic religion that is represented by night sky symbols. Islam is represented by a crescent moon and the morning star. They, just like the Jews, consider non-believers to be people that deserve to be exterminated. In fact, the Quran commands Muslims to kill all non-believers. Freemasonry has a six-pointed star on their aprons, as well as in other places. And what about communism? Communism uses a five-point star as its symbol. The British Communist Party newspaper is called the Morning Star. Let us also consider the similarity between older pagan worship and the Abrahamic religion. Now, back in the old days, we would worship volcano gods such as Zeus, the Greek god of Olympus. Now, in order to appease the angry volcano god, a lamb or a kid goat was thrown down into the red-hot volcano in order to appease the angry volcano god. The idea that sacrificing a human or a lamb or a goat could appease such a god in this day and age is totally absurd. It must not be forgotten that Judaism practiced sacrificing animals in the temple, just like all other pagan religions. So we have these religions and political ideologies that support exterminating all non-believers. For whose benefit? So I'm asking you to consider all these old-fashioned religions and reconsider what has been said in the Ten Commandments. Now, in the Ten Commandments, there are some very strange teachings, such as, I am a jealous God. You must have no other gods against my face. Now, think about it. The God who created the universe would be jealous of other gods, so there must be other gods. Also, the commandment not to insult such a God. Thou shalt not take my name in a worthless way. This suggests that the creator of the universe would have an ego? I think not. If we examine all these teachings, we need to question whether that so-called Yahweh God was really a god or an alien.
Okay, now, a couple of comments I want to make here. First off, did you notice how closely that screed he was reading off the Veterans Today website resembled a much earlier work, The Protocols of the Elders of Zion? They might have been talking about the same group of people or beings. Maybe they were. Secondly, I want to close with a story. Now, I have a longtime supporter, been with me over 30 years now, and he's not a bad guy at all, but he's into conspiracy theory. Always has been. Okay, that's not uncommon in our wee little movement. Long ago, back in the 1970s, this guy was sending me long articles and newspaper clippings from various publications, so forth and so on, to the effect that the Russians were waging weather war against the United States and were bombarding North America with microwaves from satellites to try and scramble our brains, as if 1970s America needed any help doing that. Now, this is where the whole tinfoil hat thing that liberals find so amusing comes from. Now, I reacted at the time, as you might expect. Sure, Ted, that's really very interesting. Now, can we get back to talking about niggers and Jews? Now, like I said, this wasn't a bad guy, and conversing with him consisted mainly in keeping him on topic and keeping him off his various weird little hobby horses, which, by the way, is a conversational technique that all of you future movement leaders out there need to develop. Now, frankly, I thought when it came to microwaves from space, he had a few screws loose. Then, when I was in the UK in the early 1990s, I saw a program called Panorama, which is their version of 60 Minutes, and by then the Soviet Union had fallen and Glasnost was opening up the old Soviet archives, and guess what? Old conspiracy nut Ted was right on the money. During the 1970s, the Soviets had, in fact, experimented with climate alteration and microwave bombardment from space. It didn't work, although it does kind of make me wonder about pet rocks and disco. Now, the point I'm trying to make is that we live in a world where, thanks to our several generations of raving madness at the top, truth often really is stranger than fiction. I don't believe in lizard people or serpent gods like David Icke or Bill White or the guy from Veterans Today, but if I were to find out that it was all true, I wouldn't be especially surprised. The people who rule us are capable of anything at all, and if there are aliens among us, I have no difficulty at all in believing that the United States government is in secret contact with them in order to maintain their wealth, their privilege, and their power. Let's hope not. Okay, first music break. This is by request. It's by a group called the Sons of the Pioneers, although I personally like the Marshall Tucker Band's version better. It's called Ghost Riders in the Sky.
Cowboys went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he drove. Ah, hey, yippee-i-ho! Their friends were still on fire and their hooves were made of steel. Their horns were black and shiny and their hot breath he could feel. A bolt of fear went through as they thundered through the sky, for he saw the riders coming high, and he heard their mournful cry. Aye. By him he heard one call his name. If you want to save your soul from hell, a riding on our range, then cowboy, change your ways today, or with us you will ride, I'm trying to catch the devil's herd across these endless skies. Aye.
evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to discuss a book by Adrian Murdoch. Now, this is a mainstream author who writes a book entitled Rome's Greatest Defeat, a Massacre in the Teutonoburg Forest. And this, of course, is about 9 AD, and it's about Arminius. Now, the name Arminius is often interpreted to be a Romanized version of Hermann, although some people say he might have fought in Armenia as a member of the Roman Legion. Now, Arminius was a Germanic chieftain who had been captured by the Romans and had been educated in Rome, and this type of thing was not uncommon. The Romans were very skilled in using flattery and luxury to influence Germanic leaders to pro-Roman attitudes. And this would tend to separate the chieftains from the warriors and the common people. Now, back in those days, the territory of Germany, or more specifically, between the Elbe and the Rhine, was very pacified by the Romans. And when Arminius decided to rebel, really only three other tribes sided with him. And in addition to that, Varius, who was considered a competent Roman officer, and he was considered suitable for the job of further Romanization in the Germanic area, he got intel from Segestes that Arminius was planning a rebellion, and Varius could not believe this. Most of the chieftains had been bought off, and Germany was really considered a province of Rome, and neither Varus himself nor even the Emperor Augustus could understand that there was any potential for rebellion. So when Varus got this intel, he really just thought it was evidence of an intertribal dispute. But the reason that Arminius got the allies that he did was because, for one thing, there were new tariff taxes. And second of all, many of the Germanic warriors at that time preferred to fight as mercenaries, and they really disliked the idea of going into Roman legions. So Arminius's plan was to draw the Romans to a significant but small fight. Arminius wanted Varus to be there, and he set a trap for the Romans near Colchris Hill. And the effect of this was very successful, but it was not without a price. The Romans, at about 14 AD, after going through a lot of trauma, they came back to the Germani, and they had various marching campaigns, and they tried to take revenge against the various tribes. And they were fairly successful in doing this, but they often were ambushed. Now, as a final attempt, the Romans decided to sail upriver, and they had a better result at that point and actually won a battle. But the Roman equipment was very heavy, whereas the Germans had metal shields, they had spears, whereas the Romans tended to use armor, wooden shields, and swords, so they were much heavier, whereas the Germans were light and fast. And they were also, the Germanic warriors were accustomed to a damp climate. So in many ways, this story really reads like a Northwest novel. Now, for many years, in the Middle Ages, this dramatic event was forgotten. And not until the discovery of the Tacticus Germanicus was this history rediscovered and ended up being published by Dennis in Nuremberg at around 1470. And this gave Germans back a sense of an actual past. And this was really embraced by German intellectuals, academics, playwrights, writers, and it became popular with students, particularly at Göttingen University. There were students that had grove leaves where they would go into the forest and they would try to commune with the spirit of Arminius. But around the 1800s, this gets more aggressive in tone, and Arminius is seen as secretive and duplicitous. In 1870, Bismarck tries to issue a coin. For some reason, this does not go over. But there are also paintings of Arminius commissioned, and of the battle, commissioned for a city hall. And these actually survived World War II, but were not put back up. So they must have been very exciting in a nationalistic sense. But the most exciting was a sculpture made by Joseph Ernst von Brundel, and this was a statue on Grotenburg. Now, it's very strange that Wagner never did an opera dealing with Arminius. That's possibly because he thought it might offend Catholics, because during the Thirty Years' War, the Catholics were thought of as rather foreign, whereas the Lutherans were thought of as local. Now, that may seem ridiculous to us now, because Arminius and the Roman legions had nothing to do with Christianity, but nevertheless. At any rate, in 1934, a children's book was written about Hermann, and we assume the name Hermann because Arminius is likely to be a Romanized version of that name. Once you get into, of course, Arminius was very popular in the 30s and 40s, needless to say, and was depicted in pageants. But once you get into after the war, Arminius is suddenly very unpopular, and Hans Ulrich even makes a film, Heimat, in which he says that nationalists are idiots. Now, in 1989, archaeologists rediscovered Kolkries, and they confirmed that was the actual location of the battle. So in 2002, a modern museum was built, and those with a dark sense of humor might laugh about this because visitors have a tendency to have to go on their hands and knees to see objects displayed in semi-darkness. Now, this is done to keep the viewer very disoriented and to find the subject of heroism unpleasant. The author of this book is very happy that history is now being looked at objectively, and says that imperial globalists should always win hearts and minds with effective propaganda. Now, if you're interested in Roman armor, there's a lot about this in the appendix. I found this story very inspiring because it reminds us that a hero is someone who cannot be bought. And I'm often very sad to learn about people who have been bought off by luxuries and money. And so I thought this book review would be inspiring. And I chose this particular book because not only did it talk about the battle itself, but it also had some social commentary in terms of how Hermann has been understood in German art and literature. So I hope you enjoyed this review and found it inspiring. Hail victory, comrades.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. Today, I'm going to cover how the Northwest American Republic could be brought into existence, as I promised to do about a month ago. Before I do that, there's a housekeeping matter I need to clear up. There's a long-standing trend in the communications the party has sent, especially from young men, and once again, it's time for a little spaced repetition on the matter. Like I said last time I was on, there are quite a few people who emailed the party asking about what they need to do, outside of migration itself. I'm baffled because even when someone intends to come home, they're unable to discern what needs to happen in that process, even though the party and I are quite clear on the subject. And to follow up briefly on a short tangent I went on last time, I need to answer a specific question the party was sent as part of a long email I'm responding to today. One of the usual sort sent us an email which I hope someone replied to. It's been almost 2 weeks, and if this guy hasn't heard back from someone, I do apologize. The first inquiry of his I'd like to respond to is whether or not he would be welcome among the party associates in the homeland. He lists his use of tobacco and tattoos as reasons he might not be accepted. In addition to religious gripes I get from anyone and everyone, I also end up fielding quite a few questions about why the Northwest Front dislikes people with tattoos. Of course we don't dislike those having tattoos, but as always, reality doesn't seem to factor into these situations. I don't at all mean this to apply to the author of the email. It's an issue I'm asked to clarify on a regular basis. I'm well aware that the subject of tattoos has come up a few times on Radio Free Northwest, as well as in a shortcast about the NF and class. Tattoos are identifying marks, and the party discourages them for that and other reasons. When we're talking about people we don't want around, we mean white trash, sad sacks, and other sorts of degenerates. Tattoos do not disqualify someone from association with the party, and to think we've said anything to the contrary must be, on some level, deliberate. We're probably looking at that deliberate refusal to understand thing which Radio Free Northwest has brought up from time to time. The second thing out of this email which really needs an answer is the general request for communication. He asks for links to information, literature, and discussion on other information about the Northwest Front, and the situation in the homeland as it pertains to his desired work. Specifically, he asks about agriculture and construction. I don't have an answer to his inquiry, but there are farms all over the homeland, even in the highly populated areas. Construction is almost totally going to be located in the more populated areas, and certainly not consistently in rural locations. That's a pretty obvious remark to be sure, but it's not obvious to everyone and fits a trend we see a lot of over email. In general, this trend I'm remarking on consists of person after person, and there are quite a few of them, telling us they're ready for a scouting trip and or migration, but they need to know where to go and what to do. Outside of very general observations regarding each region of the homeland, no one in the party can answer these questions in the level of detail required for someone to make a choice about where their homecoming destination should be. These generalities are essentially common knowledge and could be located on the internet with minimal effort. The specifics are things only each individual can decide because migration should land a person where they will personally prosper in the homeland. That particular location is something a person can only answer for themselves. That said, I'm happy to convey any input others in the homeland have about agriculture and construction to this guy if it's presented to me. Most importantly, he asked for guidance, opportunity, responsibility, and the promise of a real, tangible future, to use his words. Well, we've given plenty of guidance, and he tells us he's known about the Northwest Front for some time now. There's plenty of opportunity in the homeland, so that's taken care of too. It's our responsibility to create the Northwest American Republic, so there's that dealt with. I can't promise anything about the future, since it depends on the actions of all of us, but I do note he asks for hope if we can't give him a promise. Well, that I can do for sure. Hope, like enthusiasm, is an emotion, and emotions can be controlled. Hope can, therefore, be something a person gives themselves. The Northwest American Republic is our single remaining hope for the sort of world we all want. And more importantly, it's a valid hope, because we really can have our own country in the Pacific Northwest if we want to. But how? Well, that's no secret to those of you who have read the Northwest Independence novels. The party and I harp on people to read the books. Harold has made them available in PDF format free of cost, because they weren't written with the purpose of making money. Which, for all intents and purposes, they don't, in case you were wondering. Here's the deal. The way to get a country, such as America, to give up territory is to make it want to do so. The way a government wants to do something is if it is the lesser of two evils. From a bureaucrat's perspective, that means one cost must outweigh another. So we have to make holding on to the Pacific Northwest more costly than the problem of letting it go. While the novels are full of all sorts of fun stuff, this point is made only once or twice, and it's easy to miss. What we're looking to do has been done a few times within living memory, and many times just beyond living memory. In all of history, there have been many, many examples of liberating colonial territories from the hands of incredibly powerful and wealthy empires. In the end, they always give up for the same reason. In fact, America was driven out of Iraq and is quickly failing in Afghanistan, as evidenced by the recent disaster where an American general was killed by the same sort of asymmetric warfare which has plagued America in the Middle East for almost a decade and a half. The fact of the matter is that the locals have, with the exception of a couple weeks here and there at the beginning of each conflict, always beaten America despite its funding, technology, and manpower. Eventually, America will be forced to cut and run entirely because they're only incurring losses. So why the books, then? Well, as the author says, we need to get a couple different pictures in our heads. One is of white people actually winning. The other is of the finished picture, like the front of a puzzle box. It's true Harold Covington's creative ability as an author means his best method to introduce new ideas is in the form of a book, but books have another more important benefit. Trying to communicate new and somewhat unusual ideas to an audience seemingly hell-bent on avoiding the one strategy which might actually save us requires suspension of disbelief. Political polemics in the form of fictional novels are a great way to do this. I had planned a very different talk for today, but everything I wanted to say just led back to the novels. If you want to learn more about what goes on in the novels, read them, and then read the relevant portions of the party's recommended reading list. Hail victory, comrades.
After last week, I got a request for some more Doc Watson, so here you go.
For to wind up the concert with tonight, we'll do a medley of two more of the old-time fiddle tunes. Salt Creek, or Salt River, I think the old tune was originally called, and that good old Bill Cheatham.
Okay, running long, so I think we'll skip the Who Guards the Guardians this week. Don't worry, I have a wealth of material on the corruption and cock-ups of federal law enforcement. I can keep that series going for years. But I ended last week by telling you folks that this week we were going to go deeper into the subject of which organizational approach is best for the Northwest Front. Will it be either the traditional Rotary Club, come one, come all approach, where you fill out an application form and get a membership card and a secret decoder ring, and somebody provides a compound or a cow pasture somewhere, and once or twice a year, everybody goes there for a big picnic where every third person is a police agent or an undercover reporter of some kind. I.e., do we basically try to get some land out in the boondocks somewhere and try to recreate the Aryan Nations and or the National Alliance like Hollywood expects us to? Or do we go the other way, the secret squirrel way, which basically consists of expending 90% of our effort in a futile attempt to try and hide, so that we can send secret encrypted messages on our computers to a group of maybe 5 or 6 people around the world, which is generally the size of the average circle of white racial internet contacts that most of you guys have. The first way, the Rotary Club formal membership way, has been proven largely ineffective over the past 60 years, while the second way, the secret squirrel way, has proven to be completely ineffective. Either way, nothing gets done and the white race becomes extinct by the year 2100. Okay, when you have one possible modus operandi that is mostly ineffective, and a second which is completely ineffective, it should be obvious that you try and meld the two, take the necessary bits and pieces from the second MO to try and fix what's wrong with the first. This is what the fifth edition of the White Book does, although already the situation has changed enough so that after less than a year, it looks like we may have to tweak it some more and come out with a sixth edition to make the NF better able to process a much larger influx of people, which, believe it or not, we anticipate is going to happen soon. I repeat that those of you who do not have a copy of the 5th edition White Book need to contact me at nwnet@earthlink.net. That's nwnet@earthlink.net, and I'll send you a free PDF copy. Now, rather than sit here and read chapters from the manual to you, let me see if I can give you a quick rundown on the realities that we face here. Okay, first off, every white nationalist and every dissident needs to have the name of Edward Snowden engraved on his forehead or some other appropriate portion of his anatomy. Snowden confirmed what we had all known in the back of our minds was true, specifically that the Zionist surveillance state is doing its technological best to achieve the goal of all surveillance states, which is to watch everybody all the time. Even the East German Stasi never quite got that far. It's true that at one point, 1 out of every 3 East Germans was a Stasi informer, spying on his neighbors and reporting on their activities and movements. But that was back in the days of paper, before technology had advanced to the point which makes 1984 at least partly possible. Now, it's not just intercepting and archiving for all time everybody's emails and phone calls. In large parts of Europe, and especially the United Kingdom, people are under closed-circuit TV surveillance from the moment they step outside their homes in the morning until they come home at night. And in some cases, where there are what's called ASBOs, they are under electronic surveillance inside their homes to make sure that they don't do something that some judge has told them not to do. Now, what we need to understand, first off, is that the evil men and women who rule us are not going to give up this power. Tyrants never voluntarily surrender any power once they attain it. They have to be forced to do so, and we've made it pretty clear that we have no intention of ever doing that. So this surveillance state crap is going to go on for a long time until we decide to make them stop. Never mind anything you hear or read about the Supreme Court or Congress promising to put a stop to it. That's not going to happen. Remember, the purpose of democracy is to prevent change. Now, these wicked people have this power, and they are not going to give it up. They are going to keep on spying on us at this level, and we can take that as our given starting point. So, until such time as we do decide to actually make them stop, how do we proceed? What they want us to do, of course, is to give up. Oh no, Harold, we can't do anything at all to resist. They watch us all the time. They intercept our emails and our texts. We can't even make a move without their knowing, so we can't do anything at all. The bad men in the black body armor will come and hurt us. No, Mr. Bill, etc., etc., etc. But let's assume that we are sufficiently nagged by conscience so that we have to do something, or at least we have to convince ourselves that we're doing something in order not to feel completely disgusted and full of self-loathing. First off, please bear in mind that I am talking about us actually doing something to put a stop to all of this, as in generating something besides words. Sending each other emails and links on our computers, encrypted or otherwise, does not constitute doing something. Endless production of words on the internet does not constitute doing anything at all. Speech is speech. It is not an act. This is what so many of our people either don't get or fear to acknowledge. And that is that the time for words is pretty much gone. Our cause already has enough words, both printed and online. We have 5 Northwest novels. We have the 2006 draft Constitution of the Northwest American Republic. We have the program of the party and the content of the NorthwestFront.org and NorthwestFront.net websites, not to mention something like 240 of these Radio Free Northwest podcasts. We have all the written and spoken words we need. The time has come now for deeds, physical acts, not necessarily violent acts. There's all kinds of things that you can do that are entirely legal which can move this cause forward. And this is why we say that unlike every other movement in the white racially conscious community, the Northwest Front is not word-based. It is deed-based in that the basic act of commitment to the Northwest Republic is not an application form. It is not something that you say. It is something that you do. You pack your gear and you physically come home right here where you're supposed to be. Not Texas, not Bakersfield, not Florida, not the Jersey Shore, not Devil's Outhouse, Tennessee, or wherever. In the Northwest Front, your membership number is your zip code. So, how best do we encourage this kind of deed-based commitment to the 14 words? Do we use the Rotary Club technique with its membership cards and secret decoder rings, and which generates a whole raft of problems involving the poor character of white Americans, problems that we've been dealing with for almost 60 years now, and which tear down and destroy every effort we make once we reach a certain level? In other words, do we uphold the traditional definition of stupidity and keep on doing the same thing over and over and over again while expecting a different result each time? Or do we try to go all secret squirrel and operate in some internet underground which exists only in our own minds, and which consists basically of trying to conceal from the secret police agencies the fact that we're sending out whining, complaining emails to one another which they already know? Look, when I first started this some years ago, I advocated that you guys read John le Carre spy novels to get some idea as to what I wanted you to do. Very few of you actually seem to have taken that to heart. Those books will give you a general idea of who you need to be and how we need to proceed, but if I can't get you to read them, there's no point. Now, there's one thing you have to get through your heads. Any attempt to hide from these people is stupid and futile. They already know who you are. They just may not be paying you any attention yet. They have intercepted and stored every single email and text message that you have ever sent. It simply passes the bounds of credibility that in all the years since you became racially aware, you have never sent anybody an email with a racial remark or an N-word or some nasty comment about Israel in it. It's in the archives, and eventually when they can hire the clerical staff at those big warehouses in West Virginia and Utah, somebody will read it and put you on the radar, adding your name to their white supremacist databases. Secret squirrel is pointless, people. That ship has sailed, whether you like it or not. Effectively speaking, if you hold any racial dissident views at all, the only way to prevent the dictatorship from knowing about it is to maintain complete silence in every word and deed, which of course is what the dictatorship wants you to do. And the purpose of all the psychological warfare and the intimidation and the boasting about their electronic capabilities on TV shows like 24 blah blah blah. This does not mean that you should now go all Rotary Club and go running down the street yelling nigger, nigger, nigger at the top of your lungs, or jump up on the table in the break room and cut loose with a racial tirade and lose your job forthwith. That's just silly. You know, there is such a thing as common sense. You're going to be hearing that boring phrase a lot on here. Plain and simple common sense, people. Now, if you really can't live with being a meek little mouse who never so much as squeaks in protest in fear of the terrible bad men in the black body armor who might hurt you, now if you find that in order to live with yourself, you have to do or say at least a little something to convince yourself that you're not a total cowardly piece of shit, then there are ways to go about it that are not totally safe, nothing ever is, but which have what you might call an acceptable risk factor. And with a wee bit of just plain common sense, you can not only keep out of the orange jumpsuit and the steel accessories, but you can be at least ever so slightly effective. Every day you should try to inflict at least one small pinprick into the hide of the beast, because 1,000 pinpricks put together every day can bleed the beast out. Now, lest we forget what we're all aiming for here, what we're trying to bring about is a 21st century version of this.
Sons of Scotland, I am William Wallace, William Wallace is 7 feet tall.
Yes, I've heard. He kills men by the hundred. And if he were here, he'd consume the English with fireballs from his eyes and bolts of lightning from his arse. I am William Wallace. And I see a whole army of my countrymen here in defiance of tyranny. You've come to fight as free men. And free men you are. What will you do with that freedom? Will you fight?
Fight against that? No! We will run!
And we will live. Die. Fight and you may die. Run and you'll live. At least a while. And dying in your beds many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom!
Right. For those of you who are all confused and depressed and mired in defeatism because you're convinced that rebellion is futile, that the enemy is omnipotent, omnipresent, and all-knowing, a mighty, uncrackable monolith that we can never bring down, I want to close this week's episode by telling you guys a little story from our people's wondrous past. Yeah, it's Grandpa Simpson time. Now, do I need to tell you people that I am not a communist or in any way pro-communist? Probably, because I apparently still need to keep reassuring you that I'm not pro-Muslim. Never mind all that goo-boo dreck. I am going to tell you a story about the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, and I want you to forget the Bolshevik part. Don't worry about that. Just remember the revolution part. Love them or hate them, those kooks and kikes fomented the biggest revolution in human history in 10 days that really did shake the world. And we are foolish if we will not learn from them. Now, in the time of the Tsar, from the mid-1880s on, the Russians maintained what might be called the first modern secret police agency in order to protect the regime from the very genuine threat of Jew anarchist terrorism and communism. This first modern secret police force was called the Okhrana, and their techniques foreshadowed many of those used later by agencies like the KGB, the FBI, the Iranian Savak, the Israeli Shin Bet, so forth and so on. They kept enormous files on thousands of Russians, including the first covert surveillance photograph of early communists in the street and coming in and out of meetings, safe houses, that kind of thing, some of which have been published and are really fascinating glimpses of history. The Okhrana intercepted electronic communications such as telegraph messages, and they later instituted history's first telephone taps, working out of the telephone exchanges in Moscow, Petersburg, Minsk, Odessa, and all the major Russian cities. The Okhrana intercepted the mail, steamed open letters, copied the contents, and then they resealed them and sent them on. They followed targeted individuals all over everywhere for months at a time. Okhrana files can literally, in some cases, tell us what Lenin had for breakfast on a certain day in 1909. The Tsarist secret police not only riddled the various leftist groups with informers, they infiltrated the leadership of the various revolutionary organizations and often took it over. Now, is any of this starting to sound familiar? The leader of the 1905 revolution, which almost succeeded, was Father Gapin, an Okhrana informer. And when Gapin started to come unglued and spill the beans, he was murdered by the top assassin in the Red Underground, a man named Azef, who was also an Okhrana asset. In 1911, the Russian Prime Minister Stolypin was assassinated by a man named Dmitry Bogrov, who was, you guessed it, an Okhrana agent, who seems to have forgotten which side he was working for, which is always a risk with double agents. Now, from 1912 onward, the head of the Bolshevik Parliamentary Party in the Duma was a man named Roman Malinovsky, who was take a guess, an O'Connor mole who, in addition to handsome cash payments from the secret police, was also paid in cases of expensive imported scotch. There have been repeated insinuations by historians down through the years that Stalin himself in his younger revolutionary days was an O'Connor informer for a while, and he used his secret police contacts to do in various rivals of his own in the revolutionary underground. Looks like old Joe was purging his enemies even before he came to power. Again, is all this starting to ring a bell here? Now, Lenin and the Bolshevik leadership were in exile in Europe for most of that period. Inside Russia, Stalin was Lenin's right-hand man for the bank robberies and the bombings and the terrorism stuff, and Malinovsky was Lenin's right-hand man for the legal stuff in the parliament and so forth and so on. So Vladimir Ilyich may have had O'Krana informers for both his top lieutenants inside the country. And yet the Russian O'Krana, with all their contemporary super-duper state-of-the-art surveillance and their mail tampering and their files and their infiltrators and their constant dispatch of thousands of people to Siberia, for all of that, they failed. In 1917, the regime they spent a generation protecting from the consequences of its own senility and incompetence went crashing down in flames, just like the United States of America is going to do. They could follow Stalin all over Moscow and Lenin all over Europe. They could murder and they could arrest and flog and exile, but they couldn't save their beloved Tsar from Rasputin and World War I. There is an inevitability about certain times and events in history. Tsarist Russia went down because it was time, just as the United States of America will go down when it is time and not before. It's looking more and more like that time may be within our lifetimes, which I admit I never expected when I was younger. Everybody keeps asking me, when, Harold, when, like I have some kind of crystal ball. I don't. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that 20 years from now, one way or the other, the United States of America as we know it will not exist. That is going to happen one way or the other. The question is, how are you going to conduct yourself during that time period? There is no point in trying to hide. They will always know who you are and where to find you. You cannot hide from your enemies. All you can do is hide from your friends. There is no point in running out in the streets in groups of five or six people waving signs. We've all been there and we've done that. So what do we do? We'll get into that next week. But for now, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anaban. Freedom.